You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, 41% of Americans now say they often or sometimes avoid the news. We'll find out why many are tuning out and what it means for the media, as well as the health of our democracy. First, the digital streaming world is getting ready for another shakeup. Disney, Apple, AT&T, and NBC Universal are some of the companies that are launching their own streaming services in the next year. That means popular titles like The Office, Friends, and the Marvel Cinematic Universe would be reclaimed by their parent companies, and if we want to keep watching them, it might take an extra subscription or two. Companies are hoping those high-profile titles convince users that more services are worth it. Edmund Lee covers the media industry for the New York Times. Ed, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it seems like these streaming services are just mushrooming, Ed. We're seeing this huge growth. What's going on?
Well, basically, what these big media companies are seeing is that fewer people are paying for television, cable, satellite TV, which has been growing for decades and decades, but it started to contract, you know, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, where people either dropped their cable bill or lowered their cable bill in favor of things like Netflix, right, which was relatively cheap. And so as this trend started going on, Disney and Time Warner, which is now part of AT&T, and others basically say, you know what, the future is in what they call direct consumer, what we know as streaming. So they're now saying, hey, look, we own all this content. Let's sell it to people directly instead of through these third parties like cable and satellite providers.
When there was just one big streamer like Netflix, that's one thing. Then you had some Hulu and then Amazon Prime. Are consumers going to be faced with some tough choices as more and more of these things come on the market?
That's a great question. I mean, with more of these things coming on the market, you could conceivably see people paying for 4 or 5 or 6 different streaming services. All of a sudden, you've got a cable bill all over again. Of course, each service is relatively cheap on its own. But if you want to sort of see the range of things you're used to seeing, you might end up having, you know, 4 or 5 of these services. Each one costs, on average, somewhere around $10 a month. And so all of a sudden, on top of an internet bill or a broadband bill, which is somewhere around $40 or $50 a month, you might be paying another $40 or $50, and it's $100. So if you really want to economize, which is the point originally, you're not going to be able to have all of these services. Otherwise, you just sort of defeat the purpose and you're paying for cable all over again.
With Netflix, part of the appeal for people was you could watch a lot of different stuff, TV shows, movies from a lot of different producers. Are we going to start seeing shows and movies disappear from Netflix so that they go back to their walled gardens for the companies that created them?
Yeah, you mentioned at the top of the segment of things like the Marvel Cinematic Universe, which is owned by Disney. You're seeing some of that on Netflix right now, but that's going to go away after this year. Disney service is going to launch around November, and as these sort of rights roll off of services like Netflix, you'll only be able to watch them on Disney. Same with The Office, which will go to NBC Universal streaming service next year, and Friends, which it was just announced today that AT&T, the parent company of Time Warner, will hold it back for its streaming service, which they're now calling HBO Max. So we're sort of entered this phase of what, you know, people call a content cold war, where, you know, the owners of the content are keeping them off of other services just for their own streaming play.
And what gets weird is we hear a name like AT&T is doing it. Well, AT&T, I don't think of them as a content producer. Or Disney, you think of Mickey Mouse and princesses. These companies own a lot of different media properties, right?
Exactly. There's a whole wave of consolidation that happened last year in particular. AT&T, you know, bought Time Warner. They've renamed it Warner Media. But Time Warner has, you know, HBO and Turner and Warner Brothers Film Studios, a whole host of content that sits behind it. Disney owns Marvel, Lucasfilm, Pixar. And then it went after 20th Century Fox, which is part of Rupert Murdoch's empire. He sold it off mostly. Disney won that. And this was all sort of as a preface to this sort of streaming that's starting now, which is, you know, once upon a time, there used to be content producers on one side and content distributors on another, and they sort of sold back and forth. Now it's like I own the content and I distribute it. And that's where this sort of cold war is happening.
Talking to Edmund Lee from the New York Times about a growth in the number of streaming services available. You may have to pick and choose more if you want to watch different TV shows and movies and maybe pony up another monthly subscription fee. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you subscribe to 1 or 2 or 5 streaming services? Are you steering clear? Have you dumped cable? Do you want to go back to cable? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Ed, is that one possible outcome? People see this growing list of streaming services and say, maybe cable wasn't so bad after all?
I think there are definitely some who might think, maybe I'll just keep my cable bill, especially if it's got the basic channels, where a lot of these shows are kind of available. Like Friends is an interesting example. It's been on Netflix for years, but if you live in the New York area where I do, and my cable provider's Charter, we have a bunch of stations that air Friends, and I'm sure it happens all over the country, in syndication, right? So every night around 11 o'clock, Friends shows up on two or three different networks, and you can just sort of watch it any time, almost every night. Meanwhile, a lot of younger people who don't have any cable, they're tuning into Friends through Netflix, specifically, every night. They're sort of doing their own programming. So in a weird way, it's sort of they're just replicating what's already happening. It's sort of this parallel universe. Of course, Netflix is cheaper than even a cheaper cable bundle. But it's becoming a tough choice. I think Netflix still has a certain advantage right now, just given that it was the first streaming service, at least the first one of any real note. And it's just harder for people to give up the thing that they first had.
Are we going to see everybody try to come up with a killer app? HBO will have their Sopranos or Game of Thrones that gets people to pay to subscribe to that. CBS said, hey, there's a new Star Trek series, but it's only streaming. You have to pay and get all our other stuff with that. Is that going to be a goal, that one show for a lot of these guys that drags people in?
And that's the thing. I think that's a right way of putting it. I think the killer show becomes the killer app, right? There's that one thing that you can't live without, that you have to watch. I think in the case of HBO, as you mentioned, Game of Thrones has been that thing. And I think for a lot of viewers, they're anticipating the next Game of Thrones or next Game of Thrones type of show from HBO. So, yeah, fine, I'll pay for this HBO Max thing where I get HBO plus all these other things. AT&T, they're investing in other original content specifically for the streaming service that you may not see in syndication on cable or anywhere else or ever in the theater. So that is a newer phenomenon as well, which is, instead of it something that you sort of once saw, you can only ever see it originally on streaming, and they're developing content specific and native to these new streaming services. It's just going to get more complicated, and I think it will become more difficult for consumers. Again, if there's that one show from HBO and that one show from Netflix and that one show from Amazon you have to have, you're locking yourself into at least three services, and then you sort of might hit that limit. You're like, okay, now I can't afford anything else, or I don't want to pay for anything else, and you sort of live in that universe.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Brad is with us in Saukville. Brad, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What do you think?
Actually, the gentleman you're with just nailed it on the head. I mean, NBC and then they all want to do these subscription services, but let's be honest here, besides The Office and maybe one or two other shows, there's not much out there. So I'm not going to pay $10 to $15 a month for one, maybe two shows at best. Netflix and Amazon Prime. Disney, I can understand. Disney's got, like you said, Lucasfilm, Marvel Cinematic, the movies, the TV shows, and then the 20th Century Fox now that they've acquired. They've got a plethora of database that they could delve into. But you've got companies like NBC, Fox, I think CBS has a subscription service now. And it's so for one or two shows, it's not worth it. I'm going to stick with Netflix, Amazon Prime, maybe Disney when it comes out, because I hear they're only like $8.
Brad, thanks for the call. Brad sees winners and losers coming in this streaming war, Ed.
Yeah, I think he sort of outlined for us like what the calculation is for a lot of consumers, what's worth it. I'm generally curious to know for any of the callers who come in, like what if they have a cap or a limit on how many streaming services that they feel make sense for them. Chances are they might have a Netflix account already, or maybe they're an Amazon Prime customer and they get video with that. So you probably already have the two. Are they looking for one or two others? Is three or four the limit? I'm just curious where people sort of land on that, because if you know ahead of time, if you're budgeting ahead of time, decide, you know what, I think four streaming services is about where my limit is, both budget-wise and just sort of, in terms of the amount of content I know I'll actually consume, what's that third or fourth service? Or what are these four services that they're anticipating buying into? I think just from a reporter standpoint, I'm curious to know where those limits are.
Talking to Ed Lee right now. He covers the media industry for the New York Times. We're looking at what the digital streaming world could look like with a lot of new services coming online. Disney, Warner, NBC, Apple. Back to your calls now. Christina is with us in Glenwood City. Christina, hi.
Hi there. Thank you. This is very timely for me. We were just talking about dumping our satellite. So with these changes, can you suggest an economical and varied package? And also, how does Amazon Prime fit in?
Thanks for the call, Ed. I don't know if you have consumer tips, but any thoughts for Christina?
No, it's a great question, of course. If you're a first-time sort of, you know, cord cutter is what they call it, even if you have satellite, I think for a lot of consumers, Netflix seems to be the sort of first choice. It started out relatively inexpensive. It's gone up in price. It's around $12 now for their standard plan. I think there's a slightly cheaper one at $8. The difference in price has to do with how many simultaneous streams you can do. So if you have, you know, multiple TVs or laptops and iPads at home and you want, you know, three or four people watching the service at the same time, you want to spring for the sort of the standard service, which gives you a few simultaneous streams, even if it's slightly more expensive. It's more convenient. To the Amazon Prime question, so what's interesting is they've bundled in their video service. They have a lot of original video and also video that's just available for streaming through Amazon Prime. The thing is, you're buying not into the video service so much as you're buying into their delivery service, right? So if you are a Prime member, whenever you buy anything on Amazon or for most items, they'll ship it to you at 2 days for no cost or no extra cost. So being a Prime member, I think it's about $120 a year. So, you know, that breaks out to somewhere, whatever it is, $11, $12 a month. I think that's, you know, that's effectively the cost of what you'd be paying into for a video subscription. If that's really all you care about, then you get the added benefit of the delivery thing. Those seem to be the two sort of strongest players right now. Hulu is also a nice option. They have an ad-supported product that's about $6 a month. So it's actually pretty inexpensive. You have to watch ads alongside that. But I think for most people who have that, say that it's fine. Lastly, I do think that the Disney service that's forthcoming, mailed in November, you know, they price it very competitively. It's about $7 a month. If you pay a year in advance, it ends up being less than $6 a month. And that's actually that's a nice deal relative to the other streaming services that are out there. HBO is the most expensive. It's $15 a month. When they launch this new service under AT&T with the other content, it'll be at least $15, if not slightly higher. So that's going to be more of a calculation for consumers. But I think to start, Netflix, Amazon seems to have the strongest backing, at least right now.
Christina, thanks for the call. Good luck with the decision. We'll go now to Paul on the line in Milwaukee. Paul, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Your guest had asked how many services somebody was willing to take, and I'm planning on having Prime and one other, and what I'll probably do is follow them all on social media and then cancel one and add another one when I have something new to binge. So I'll only pay for two at a time, but as long as they're going to let me pay monthly, I'll just pick the one that has something I want that month and cancel it at the end of the month.
Paul, thanks for the call. So serial monogamy with his streaming services, Ed.
So the caller describes a phenomenon that is actually unique to streaming, and I think a lot of people are doing exactly what he's doing, which is, you want to sort of, there's a show that you really want to watch. Say it's Game of Thrones. We talked about how HBO is the most expensive. You can buy HBO online. It's called HBO Now, where you only get HBO, and then you can cut it after a month or two, right? So you're getting billed on a month-to-month basis, and that's starkly different from how cable companies have long operated, which is, you're not so much into a contract, but you're paying a high fee every month. When you want to cut it, they make it really difficult, and they need to send someone to your house, and they might even charge you for that sort of whole operation. When Netflix came along with streaming, they actually made it very, very easy for people to turn on and off their subscription, and people have been doing that. Well, they pay for 1 month, watch a few things, cut it off, and then restart their service a few months later or a month later. So all the other streaming players that have come into the marketplace now, they've sort of had to follow Netflix's lead. So if you got HBO through your cable provider, it might be harder to turn it on and off. If you got HBO directly online through their HBO Now service, it's easier to turn it on and off. And I think, you know, that's a phenomenon we'll see more and more, especially as there are these more services coming into the fray. I think some of the services now, though, in an effort to cut that off, might sort of get you into a yearly plan, right? We mentioned Disney earlier. If you buy a year in advance, it's a little bit cheaper, you know, about $6 a month or less. So that might be a way to prevent that. But I do think a lot of people will be doing the turning things on and off, the serial monogamy, so to speak.
Paul, thanks a lot for calling in. We are talking about the growth of streaming services. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Edmund Lee is with us from the New York Times. Back to your calls. Kristen is with us in Winona, Minnesota. Kristen, hi.
Hi.
What's your story, Kristen?
So basically, I do have Netflix, and I do have Prime, mainly for the reason of the free shipping. I do not have a TV at all. I only watch on my phone, and I only watch for about a half an hour to an hour a week. I simply just find better things to do with my time.
Kristen, thanks for the call. Are these streaming services pitching toward people who watch like Kristen does on her phone, Ed?
I think Kristen's actually a bit of an outlier. I think she represents the future. I think especially younger folks tend to just sort of watch on their phones. But, you know, as an example, like Netflix, they found that 60% or more of the viewing that happens on their service happens on a big screen TV or a TV of some sort. The rest of the time, it could be on a laptop or an iPad or a phone. But they see that the bulk of their viewing still happens on a big screen. And, you know, they spend a lot of money for productions that have sort of big screen capabilities with, you know, sort of special effects and explosions. Stranger Things, which is their one of their big plays, has a lot of special effects, and I think plays well on a big screen. At the same time, I do think the future or the near future is people just watching things on their phone or watching less. And I think they're all trying to anticipate that to some degree and maybe develop content that fits that idea.
Kristen, thanks a lot for the call. Edmund, I want to talk a little more about original content. It seems like some of these new players, including Apple, are going to be putting a lot of money trying to get big-name producers, directors, and stars in the stuff that they make to show on their streaming service.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. Apple is sort of still of a mystery to a lot of us in terms of exactly what their larger strategy is. They're spending anywhere from $1 billion to $2 billion a year to develop this content. That's a lot of money, but relative to, say, Netflix, which is spending $10, $12, $15 billion a year, it's much smaller. The difference with Apple relative to these other streaming services is that I think Apple, in many ways, is trying to be more like a cable provider in that what they want is a unified interface where you as a consumer can sort of pick and choose. You can sort of buy into a CBS all-access streaming service or, you know, ideally they wanted Netflix, but Netflix is not participating. But like CBS or HBO or any of these other streaming services that are coming soon, and they just want to own the interface to sort of whet people's appetites and get them used to it. They will also have original content that is specific to Apple, but it's not going to be a ton of stuff. I mean, a dozen shows maybe or even two dozen shows is not quite enough to justify a full-on streaming service on its own. And they might even make that part free to Apple customers. So if you own an Apple device, you might be able to watch this stuff for free. But at the same time, they want to upsell you into subscribing to these other third-party services like HBO or CBS. They will get a small cut of that. But ultimately, they just want to own the interface.
Let's bring on another caller now. Drew is with us in Deerfield. Drew, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to like the topic a lot, but as far as like the bills go or the how many services you would like set the limit to, I know in our household we don't have any cable or anything like that. We just do all the streaming, and we don't really set it to an amount of apps as to what the bill comes out to, as long as it's cheaper than cable. Also, the other one that seems to be a pretty good app is Hulu. I think the host mentioned that just because it hosts or has a lot of the current shows from a lot of the basic channels. But then I think up to new channels being starting their own streaming service, I wonder how many of those are actually going to be retained.
Drew,
that's about it, though.
Thanks a lot for the call. So Drew and his family set a budget. As long as they come out cheaper than the cable would have been, they're okay with it, Ed.
No, that's a smart way to think about it. And I think you can still get three or four of these streaming services end up being under what a basic cable service might be. The caller had a question about Hulu. Mm-hmm. I think Hulu is another interesting example. They're all playing in slightly different modes here. Hulu, they're known for what they call like next day content. So stuff you might see on your broadcast networks like NBC, ABC, NBC and ABC, you know, these shows would then appear on Hulu the next day. And if you pay the $6 a month, you're seeing ads next to it. There's a higher priced one about $12 a month, and you don't see any ads at all. we should note that Hulu is now actually controlled by Disney. So Disney actually, they've been doing a lot of these M&A deals in the last year. Hulu came part of this whole, you know, Fox deal that they did. And so now Disney will have Disney Plus, which is its own streaming service with all its the movies that we know that they own, but then also Hulu, which will have a lot of the TV content that you might see from the broadcasters. Now, because it's now controlled by this one entity, you know, a broadcaster like NBC, which is owned by Comcast, might be less willing to sell its content to Hulu and might want to keep it for its own service. So again, it's going to get even more complicated going forward. Not a good answer to the caller's question right now, but you know, we have to wait and see as to where those things end up shaking out. And it all comes down to sort of the big corporate media guys pulling the strings. What's better for their own streaming service versus the other?
Thanks a lot for that call, Ed. In just a few moments, what is the next big thing you're watching out for when it comes to this streaming chaos?
So Disney's coming out in November. Apple is supposed to come out around the same time, maybe a little bit more. The big thing for me right now is that AT&T service, which is HBO Max, I mean, we still don't know how they're going to price it. They're going to launch it early next year, and HBO is still a big player and draws a lot of consumer interest, but how they price it will make a big difference. Chances are it's going to be $15 or more, and it'll be a tough call for them, but that's what I'm looking for, because that's what consumers will ultimately be reacting to, what it costs.
Ed, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure, anytime.
Edmund Lee covers the media industry for the New York Times. He talked with us about how new streaming services coming online this year could shake up the way we watch stuff. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. If you've ever felt like the news was stressing you out and you couldn't take it anymore, you're not alone. A new report from the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism finds that 41% of Americans often or sometimes avoid the news. That number has gone up in recent years. While people often talk about a lack of trust in the media, the number one reason for avoiding the news, according to the survey, was stress and mental well-being. Joshua Benton joins us now to talk more about news avoidance and what it means for the media, for media consumers, and the health of our democracy. He's founder and director of the Nieman Journalism Lab at Harvard University. Joshua, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
Well, we see this survey, other research out there on news avoidance. Is this something new? Is this new news that we're avoiding the news?
It's certainly not a new behavior entirely. Obviously, some people have always been more or less checked out from the news. I do think the one thing that is fundamentally new is that as we've transitioned from a primarily mass media transmission of news, you know, broadcast television, broadcast radio, a daily print newspaper, once you shift that to first the internet and then smartphones, people just have a wildly greater number of choices of what to consume at any given moment. So you had some people who were consuming news under that old broadcast model, not necessarily because they wanted to seek it out, but because they didn't have that many other choices. If you wanted to, you know, watch television at 6 o'clock at night when I was a kid, you were watching the news. That was the only thing on. Now people have an infinite array of distractions available on their phone, and that means that people who are loosely attached to it are increasingly detaching themselves from the news.
Let's get into this idea that the news is stressing us out. You wrote about this and you wrote about comments on this study. And we heard on our own Facebook page, the Ideas Network Facebook page. For example, Janice says, for peace of mind, I must remove myself from the news occasionally or I will get sick, Janice writes. Joshua, is that something we're hearing a lot, that we're worried about the effect that too much news is going to have on our health?
I think that's true. You know, one thing that the New York Times slogan, all the news that's fit to print, for a long time that created the illusion that there was sort of a defined set amount of news and you could get to the end of it, you know, in one sitting. Now that the internet is borderless and boundaryless, the news is always around us. And I think that has increased the degree to which some people view it as with a feeling of being overwhelmed. You know, beyond that, I think that, frankly, the political moment, whatever one's politics, the rise of populist approaches and the rise of someone like Donald Trump and the environment that he brings has led a lot of people to, on one hand, be incredibly engaged with the news. You saw a big increase in news consumption during the 2016 campaign and after the election and in the early days of the Trump candidacy. But you also see some people saying, you know what, there's just too much of it. I've got other things to do and I need to, you know, practice some form of self-care and not not get too engaged in the latest turns of the screw at the White House.
You mentioned the older style of news being on a schedule. It's the TV news at whatever time, or news on the sixes on commercial radio, or I'm going to read the newspaper in the morning or afternoon whenever I read it. Now, is it something different for our mental health? Do you think that we don't have that set news time?
Yeah, I mean, it's maybe difficult for some listeners to remember what it was like before the internet. More and more people come along every day who have no memory of that time. But you know, if I wanted news during the day when I was growing up, there were only like two slots in the day that it was really available to me, and no matter how much I wanted to know what was going on at 2 p.m. in the afternoon, I couldn't. Right. And now that we get a lot of our news through push notifications and things that are, you know, an email alert that shows up in our inbox, there is a sense that news is coming after us and it's chasing us in a sense. And I think there's some people, you know, and I'll admit I'm one of these people, most journalists are. Some of us love this sort of environment. We love consuming news. We find it fascinating. We want to dive into it. I bet a lot of your listeners fall into that category. But there's some people for whom that's the exact opposite of what they want.
Some comments out there, and you talk about this in the piece I mentioned that you wrote, feel a sense of powerlessness. There's so much bad stuff going on. There's this fire hose of news, and it feels like we can't do anything about it. Is that a common theme you run across?
Yeah, that's one thing that a lot of people have been trying to address. When you have the old mass media model, one newspaper in most cities, their goal was to be sort of inoffensive. If you're the only paper in town, it doesn't help you to anger certain slices of your audience. And the result was you got a I don't want to say a bland, but a generally moderated view of what was going on at any given time. Whereas when you switch to digital, you have an incentive to try and get clicks. You have a push towards triggering people's emotions. Social media, which is an increasing source of traffic for news organizations, really relies on these emotional buttons being pushed. And that entire environment, I think, combines to the sort of situation that we're in now.
Talking to Joshua Benton from the Nieman Journalism Lab at Harvard University, talking about news avoidance, what leads people to turn away from the news all the time or part of the time. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you ever hit a point in your life where it feels like there's just too much news, maybe too much bad news, and for your own mental health, you need to steer clear? What do you do? Call 800-642-1234. Joshua, for members of the mainstream media, however you want to define that, are there lessons here about what they cover and how they cover it?
I think so. One that I try and push on people is we as journalists have typically assumed that the move to digital journalism has meant that things have to speed up. Right, that essentially a newspaper went from publishing once a day to publishing throughout the day. We take on some of the characteristics of wire services and of 24-hour broadcasting. And I think there's one lesson from this is that is going to please a certain segment of the market, but it's going to not do the opposite for perhaps a larger segment of the market. There are people for whom a weekly digital news product might be exactly what they want, who don't want to feel the obligation to be plugged in 24/7. And I think there are opportunities for publishers and for journalists to try and figure out different ways to create these sorts of products. If you look at the kinds of news formats that have really thrived in recent years, two of them are email newsletters and podcasts. And what do those have in common? They're both things that are delivered on a schedule, but you can sort of consume them at any given time. You can read the email an hour later or 2 hours later. You can listen to the podcast on the weekend when you have more time. They're also something that can be completed. Eventually, you get to the end of the email newsletter. Eventually, you get to the end of the podcast. There's a sense that it is a state of news that you enter and then have sort of permission to step away from. I think when you compare that to the endless stream of content on your Facebook news feed or on your Twitter feed, or the endless array of headlines that any news site is going to keep shoving at you, I think there's a lesson that smaller, more contained experiences can do a better job of reaching people where they want to be.
Now, talking about that feeling of powerlessness and being overwhelmed that people might have, you also touch on in your piece the idea of solutions-based journalism. What is that? What does that look like?
Sure. Solutions journalism is a term that a lot of people have been using in the last 5 or 6 years, specifically around the idea that journalism that identifies problems but then offers nothing for the reader or the consumer to act on those problems is not a particularly satisfying model, right? If you are a news organization that does a tremendous investigation into problems in your local schools, that's fine. That's wonderful. That's good, important work. But if you are a reader and you come to the end of it, you don't have any idea about how to fix these problems. It's not the kind of emotional state that is frankly going to make you want to make those people come back and read more news the next day. So the idea behind solutions journalism is whenever you present identify a problem in your community, you also need to take the next step of not being prescriptive, not being activist and saying, and this is why we need to increase funding for X, you know, by 20%, but to outline what are some communities that have faced similar problems and how have they tried to address it? What are the things that the experts say are potential paths forward that might be available to local leaders and voters to push for? The idea that news in its previous model encouraged this feeling of powerlessness and that solutions being involved in the presentation and the ideation of solutions might help close that gap.
We heard from Andrea on Facebook who says, I'm not done with news, but I have unsubscribed from quite a few sources because I think newsrooms are not intentionally lazy, just understaffed, underpaid, overworked, and inexperienced in general. How would you respond to a news consumer who says that, Joshua?
Well, I think that I don't know what kinds of news organizations she might be talking about, but I do think that there is a large and growing divide between local and national news on that front. Essentially, for a variety of business model reasons, local newspapers have been hit extremely hard by the transition to digital. National newspapers, the New York Times, the Washington Post, they're doing great. National digital news sites are doing a lot of interesting things, but there just isn't the same financial incentive to create local news. And one of the things that has been clear in the research for a long time and also just sort of makes sense is that local news is the kind of news that people connect to the most directly. Local news is much less ideologically driven than national news. You know, if you watch CNN or MSNBC or Fox News, you're going to see a war between two sides that is being fought every day, every hour, every minute. Whereas, you know, whether there are potholes in the road and whether the mayor's done anything to fix them, that's something that isn't inherently a Republican or Democratic issue. People identify with local news reporters. They know that they live in their community, that their kids go to the same schools that your kids do. They identify them. They might have seen their byline over a lengthy period of time. There's a huge amount of trust and closeness baked into local media. So this transition to digital has essentially hollowed out the part of the media ecosystem that encouraged that trust, led to the loss of a lot of jobs for a lot of really talented reporters and editors. But it's encouraged this national level that is firing on all cylinders all the time and wants to portray everything as a conflict between good and evil. And that, I think, is a recipe for the kind of loss of trust and desire of people to step away that we've seen.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Joshua Benton of the Nieman Journalism Lab at Harvard University. We're talking about why many Americans avoid the news and what news organizations can do about it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you find yourself tuning out the news sometimes, all the times, why do you do it? How could news organizations serve you better? Do you think limited news exposure is actually a pretty good idea? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Jack is with us in Madison. Jack, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Jack?
So I just had a thought about following the news right now. Now, you probably wouldn't hear anyone else bring this up on WPR, but thinking about the role the news media plays in this day and age, especially given how biased everything is, how slanted it is to one side or the other, it made me think of a line from Ozzy Osbourne's Crazy Train from the second verse where he says, "When person conditioned to rule and control, the media sells it, and you live the role." So as part of my first question, I wondered if you thought that was a generally valid statement, and that explains why a lot of people are avoiding the news today.
Jack, thanks for the call. So people skeptical of the corporate owners of media. What do you think, Joshua?
Well, if my memory serves, a Crazy Train came out in 1980, which was very much an era of the old mass media structures. You know, at that time, you know, in the 70s and early 80s, media trust was at a very high level. You know, I do think that that there have always been legitimate concerns about corporate ownership and things like that. I take that. I do think, though, that it's perhaps overstated compared to other things that cause news organizations to do unfortunate things. If you look particularly at the newspaper world, the largest newspapers in America are very they're not clustered around just one or two companies, as some people sometimes say. Of the 20 largest newspapers in the United States, they have 17 different owners. So I think corporate consolidation is a legitimate concern. I think we're going to see, frankly, a lot more of it, and that does start to become threatening at some level, I think. But I rake that relatively low on the list of causes.
Jack, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go to Kathy now in Wisconsin Rapids. Kathy, hi.
Hi.
What do you think, Kathy?
I was one of those that during the election, it consumed me and it got me worked up. I would get really frustrated. And I used to get ready in the morning and listen to Good Morning America, shut that off. I just stopped watching world news as much as possible, but still watch local. But I flipped on Relevant Radio, a Christian radio station in the morning, and I am at so much more peace when I leave for work. But I just feel like I had to do that to realize that things aren't as bad as the media makes things out to be. I think, you know, it was so gloom and doom and felt like the world was ending, and it really isn't.
Kathy, thanks for the call. Oh, I wanted to make sure you mentioned the election, the 2016 election.
Yeah.
Great. Thanks a lot for the call, Kathy. Kathy gives us a lot to talk about there. I think, Joshua, first of all, that 2016 election as a turning point for a lot of people when it came to media news saturation.
Yeah, I think, you know, every new presidential election gets branded as, you know, the Twitter election, the Facebook election. The media has changed so much. Just thinking back to Barack Obama's first election 11 years ago, that's a very different internet then. I do think that the 2016 election, both because of media technological evolution and because of the particular candidates, did feel all-consuming in a way that wasn't quite the case in, you know, Obama versus Romney or Obama versus McCain or earlier elections. And I do think that a lot of people you know, who had strong partisan identities really shifted their media diets around that time. You do see that the vast majority of media consumption in the United States is still in non-ideological spaces. It's not, you know, explicitly liberal or explicitly conservative news sites. But for the people who do want to consume that, they often consume it with an incredible intensity. There was a new study that just came out today from the Knight Foundation that looked at young people and their news consumption habits, young adults, and it found that young people who had a strong party identity, who felt that they were strongly Republican or strongly Democratic, they 32% of them are getting news stories via social media multiple times every single day. For people who are less partisan in that same group, who are independent or have a weak connection to the parties, it's only 18%. So we do see this phenomenon where when you charge people up ideologically, they get some reward from consuming ideologically aligned news and information. And that means there's a market that that people would like to sell news to. And there's a certain element of a vicious circle there. One thing I'll just say about this is that you see some of these broader trends across, say, countries in Europe and elsewhere. One thing that really does make us different in the United States is that for all the good work that folks like you and people at NPR stations and PBS stations do, we don't have a BBC. We don't have this incredible, you know, bedrock institution that's sort of at the center of the news ecosystem that is broadly trusted, that is, you know, generally considered to be not towing a specific ideological line. NPR and PBS do great work, but they're much smaller. And that is the sort of institution that would really be beneficial at this point. Some sort of, you know, people say that they have high trust levels for NPR and PBS, the two highest of any news organizations in America, but they just don't have the funding to perform that sort of centering role.
Something else that Kathy mentioned, that she felt that so much of the news was relentlessly negative. And that's something that you saw in a lot of comments out there attached to the surveys we've been talking about. Is that part of what you think is leading people to avoid the news more and more?
I think that's certainly true. I mean, that is something that has been true for a very long time, right? You know, there are lots of old cliches around it. You know, man bites dog is not a story, but dog bites man is not a story, but man bites dog is. News organizations and reporters look for the unusual, for the aberrant. That's what makes it news. So it has always been the case that looking for things that violate norms, that is something that news organizations tend to cover more. I do think that one extra factor in here is that we increasingly have a lot of media that paints any particular complicated issue in very black and white terms. You know, if you watch certain cable news shows, you'll get the impression that there's one group of people who is the absolute enemy of all that is good in the universe, and another group that is violently defending all that is good in the universe. That sort of painting everything in that stark conflict-driven terms, that is something that I think increases the impression of negativity. One thing that is unfortunately something that has been very well shown both through cable news and through what works on social media is that anger is an incredible motivating factor for people to consume information. People will click on things if it makes them angry. And there are some news organizations and journalists who are taking advantage of that.
Is there a way in our last minute or so to get around that, to de-angrify our news market, our news diet?
I mean, I'll be honest, there are a whole host of factors at work here, and they generally all seem to be pointing in the same sort of direction. There is one trend I'll mention in our last minute, which is that we have seen a broad shift away from news organizations relying on advertising for revenue and moving towards relying on subscriptions, revenue directly from readers or consumers. There are a lot of good things about that shift. Reader revenue is a lot more reliable. Advertising money has all been taken away by Facebook and Google anyway. But one of the potential negative things is that it means that there's going to be a high quality news that is going to be increasingly available for a group of people who are unusually interested in news, unusually have unusual amounts of time to invest in consuming news. These are people who are more educated than average, who have higher incomes than average. They also tend to be more liberal than average. We run the risk of creating this sort of subscription wall between the quality news that is paid for by people who can afford it and have the interest, and a broad mess of whatever shows up on your Facebook news feed that is free, is driven by, you know, clickbait and the desire to get ad impressions, and I think would probably reinforce a lot of the negative behaviors that we've been talking about.
Joshua, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Joshua Benton, founder and director of the Nieman Journalism Lab at Harvard University. He joined us to talk about why many Americans are avoiding the news and what the media can do about it. Still time for you to share your thoughts over at the Ideas Network Facebook page.